And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Looking forward to this chat tonight with physicist Nassim Haramein. Has spent most of his life researching the geometry of hyperspace, theoretical physics, cosmology, quantum mechanics, biology, chemistry. Sounds like a song, doesn't it? As well as anthropology and ancient civilizations. Combining the knowledge with a keen observation of the behavior of nature, he discovered a specific geometric array that he found to be the fundamental to creation, and the foundation for his unified theory has emerged. And Mr. Haramein founded a not-for-profit organization called the Resonance Project, where as the director of research, he continues exploring unification principles and their implications in our world today. And we're going to talk with him about many of these subjects tonight on Coast to Coast. Nassim, welcome back, my friend. How are you?
Oh, it's great to be on the show again. I've been good.
I have been flooded with emails since you were with me in August of last year. I mean, they continue to roll in.
I'm glad. People are very interested, and it's very exciting to see, so much people with good ideas and people thinking for themselves.
Absolutely. Tell me about this internet buzz. What's going on here? What have you said about it specifically? I mean, they're running all over the place saying that there's a UFO going around the sun. I want to get your take on this.
Well, you know, it's been a long journey for me to, of observing the sun. It started really when I was doing a lot of studying of ancient civilization.
Mm-hmm.
I found that, like, all these civilizations around the world were talking about sun gods and talking about them in terms of, using the sun in some kind of stargate or in some kind of way of traveling through the universe in many different cultures around the world. And they're very similar stories, and they're very coherent, and they seem to describe a very specific way the universe works and a very specific way we can travel in it. And so, I started to pay more and more attention to the sun. And in 1998, I came across a video that came from the SOHO probe where there was two objects that seemed to be solar-gazing comets that seemed to crash into the sun. And I analyzed the video carefully and found that there was some anomaly in the movements of those comets along their path towards the sun. And then they didn't have tails that seemed to be long enough for the comet's size they were, and so on.
Yeah.
And so I started to really pay attention to a lot of the information that's available to us from the SOHO probes and various other telescopes. And as I did that, I realized that I wasn't the only one that was paying attention to the sun. And it turned out that it seemed like a very large institution, one of the wealthiest and most powerful institutions on our planet, the Vatican, was actually spending a lot of time and a lot of energy looking at our sun itself.
They have been all over the map, haven't they?
They have. And, so in 1998, I started to publicly talk about this. I showed the videos in my seminars, and I talked to people about it, and I talked to various experts about it, and I got information from insiders inside JPL and others. And, I found very, very interesting data that seemed to show that there is activity around the sun that cannot be easily explained by conventional means. And, this is a question of opinion, and, it's the result of all the research I've done, but it really looks very anomalous in many cases.
Now, one of the reasons why these theories abound, do you think it's because it's very difficult to get great pictures near the sun because it blots things out?
Yes, the sun is a very energetic system, obviously. It's 99.8% the mass of our solar system. All the planets together don't even make 1% the mass of the sun. So it's very energetic. There's a lot of difficulties in analyzing the sun. Even like things that are simple that you'd think we know about the sun. For instance, its rate of rotation. We have a pretty good idea of its rate of rotation. However, because it is a plasma sphere, there's different rate of rotation around the equator and others, you know, as you go up the latitude. So even something simple as the, you know, the rate of rotation of the sun, or, you know, many dynamics that we see on the sun, for instance, the missing neutrino issues and so on, have crop up in our physics throughout the years. And, you know, observing the sun demands very expensive probes out there that are taking a beating with a lot of solar particle hitting the cameras and the lens. And so there's a lot of artifacts that comes up on these reels, on these videos, on these pictures that are taken of the sun by these probes. So it's very difficult to make a distinction between artifacts that are like particles hitting the lens, or, you know, various, compression and decompression issues that occur with, resolution issue and so on, and genuine unexplainable objects mm-hmm. that seem to show up around the sun at times.
So are you saying that what might be going on around the sun could be objects of extraterrestrial origin?
It could be. I believe so. And I'm saying this not really lightly. I mean, it is a question of opinion. However, it is not just from observation of the sun over a period of, 15 years that have been, but as well from an intense and deep study in ancient civilization and this thread that one can follow when studying ancient texts and ancient cultures around the world that talks about these advanced beings that seem to have visited our planet thousands and thousands of years ago. I mean, it's in most of the ancient traditions, and that talks about their use of the sun, their mode of traveling, their power source, looking like a little sun, and so on. And so I think there's something very, very significant there, and I think it's really, at this point in history, it's unveiling very rapidly.
Now, with a physicist with your notoriety, Nassim, you've got to be driving some of the old-line physicists nuts with some of these theories. What do you hear?
Definitely, it's definitely my opinions there diverge widely from the main views. However, you'd be surprised when you talk to physicists around the world how many physicists, will concede that there most likely is life out there, and that it's not impossible that that advanced civilization out there. I mean, when you look at our evolution, in 150 years, barely, we've gone from horse and buggy to the moon and so on, and we're flying in airplanes and all this. Imagine a civilization out there that has 1,000 years of advanced technological development. You know, they could think of traveling across the galaxy just the way we think of taking a charter plane
sure.
from here to Australia.
Or even 1,000,000 years ahead of us.
That's
my
right.
My gosh.
Yeah, and 1,000,000 years, very good. 1,000,000 years is not much in cosmological time.
No, I mean, nothing.
It's a blink of an eye.
Yeah, drop in the bucket.
That's right. And so people with that type of advancements in technology may think of moving across the galaxy, or even from one galaxy to another, or a universe from one universe to another, as something they do casually every day. And so, I think it's really important that we don't limit our minds and our scope by thinking that we must be the most advanced people out there, and that it's not possible for other people to come here because we can't go there. That's not an accurate assessment.
Now, what about this story about Mexican airlines are being told to avoid certain areas in the air to stay away from UFOs?
Yes. Well, in Mexico, there's been a lot of UFO activity, especially since the eclipse of 1990. Interestingly, the increase in UFO activity was so tremendous at one point that the Mexican government pretty well straight up admitted that there was an issue in the air, in their airspace, and that they needed to start training pilots and radio tower controllers to be able to steer around the frequently flown route that these UFOs seems to utilize all the time in the region of Mexico City. And so, you know, all that happened quite a bit of time ago, but, you know, a lot of that information, unless you dig for it, doesn't really make it into the United States. So, but, you know, since then, the Mexican government has admitted to having UFO encounters. They've released, actually, you know, Air Force footage of filming UFOs and so on. And many other countries around the world, too, has started to release files. And there's very active groups all around the world that are led by very credible people, astronauts and military personnel and so on. They're all coming forward, including the Vatican, which is what is quite remarkable.
Yeah, something's weird going on there, Nassim, isn't there?
There is. I think we're approaching a very important time in our history where we may finally encounter civilization outside of our solar system.
Are you familiar with the work of Zachariah Sitchin by any chance?
I am.
Okay. And of course, for those who don't, and Zachariah was just our guest, and you know, he contends that 400,000 years ago, beings from another planet in our solar system called Nibiru, which is on a 3,600-year elliptical orbit, came to this planet in search of gold. They needed it for their atmosphere to protect it. And they genetically altered you know, the creatures who were on this planet at the time that eventually became us. And he said he was able to decide of this by interpreting Sumerian, Iraqian templates at the time in text. What do you think of that theory?
I think Zachariah Sitchin got a lot of things right, and I think that in some way, in some areas, he made an interpretation that I don't necessarily agree with, you know. You know, one of the assertions he makes about this Planet X that I believe actually was mistranslated from planet to comet. And you find in many other cultures around the world this concept of this killer comet that comes through the solar system once in a while. And so I think that when you actually look globally at all the different texts, you get a better picture and a more complete picture of what was going on there. You know, so it's hard to tell. I mean, it depends on the interpretation of the text. And for sure, you know, many of these texts are written in very ancient languages that are very difficult to decode, and much of it has to do with the interpretation of them. Some of the texts I'm involved with right now that I'm very excited about are texts that come from ancient Indian cultures and Tamale cultures that are come from, you know, the Vedic tradition and so on, that talk about extraterrestrials and flying machines and so on.
Absolutely. I mean, ancient texts, artwork depict craft. How would they come up with this thousands of years ago?
Exactly. Even the concept of a flying machine should have been, and no pun intended, alien to a civilization thousands and thousands of years ago. I mean, some of the texts that I'm examining, some of I have a little section on my videos about that, are some, you know, are thought to be dated 13,900 years old. You know, you're talking civilizations that should have been in the dark ages of humanity evolution, people that should have been in caves, barely out of caves, and you know, for them to describe flying machines and very complex steering capabilities of these machines and complex mechanism to make them fly is remarkable, and you really don't expect that from ancient texts.
We're going to come back with you, Nassim, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And by the way, webmaster Lex has posted on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com pictures, a link of that UFO sun. Pretty amazing stuff, actually. Pretty amazing indeed. And, you know, you can go over there and become one of our Twitter friends. So just get up there to coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a moment at Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with physicist Nassim Hedemain. Nassim, last night, Coast to Coast guest Richard Hoagland, who's a regular contributor and our science advisor as well, heads up the enterprisemission.com.
Yes.
He claimed that that spiral in Norway was the remnants of fuel from a grabbed, captured Russian missile that he believes a shadow government, I'm going to use that, that a shadow government has incredible technology that could down a missile, capture it, that they wanted the world to really know what they were doing and the clout they did have. What are your thoughts on that thing?
Well, that's very interesting. I hadn't heard that one. But I don't know, it's a very difficult analysis. You know, there's so much information out there. And when we look at the footage and the information that's available, it's a very difficult thing to decipher and to try to come to a positive deterministic conclusion. However, you know, I tend towards, from the analysis I've made, from the studies I've done, and from my understanding of certain levels of technologies that we have, most likely the phenomenon that's seen over Norway is the result of a ground facility that has an array of antennas, best known as the HARP.
I know it well. The one in Alaska, and there's also one out that area, right?
That's right. There's one right near that area, ionic atmospheric heating facility. And, when you look at the footage, you look at the rotational dynamics of these spirals and the dynamics you see that seem to go to a ground effect and, and then as well, there's all sorts of information that supports that. For instance, large surges in their power consumption during that time, during that night, those plots are available and so on from that facility. And various effects that were observed from other HARP phenomena prior to this incident that were very similar to a similar effect. I think that it all starts to add up, and it's pretty conclusive. But there's no way that we can absolutely say what, in my case anyway, what has happened there. But I think it all points to that direction. And in one way, I'm a little, it's kind of a pinch in the heart if this is what is happened there, because I think that when the spiral finally dissipates and it opens in what people call a black hole, and, you know, because I do black hole physics,
yeah,
and I deal with all this, I got a lot of emails. A black hole occurred over Norway and all this. And when I looked at it, and knowing what these devices do to the ionosphere, I believe that the dissipation that occurred when the black hole opened is actually a hole being poked in our ionosphere. And that's why the energy actually dissipated.
What about CERN? CERN's been active lately. Is it possible something's going wrong there?
You mean the Hadron Collider?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's been a very difficult project. It's been plagued with difficulties from the beginning. It's a very highly powerful accelerator. I'm actually surprised that not all of Europe dims when they turn that thing on. But, it is a very difficult thing to do, what they're trying to do there. And so they've had various difficulties. Every time they turn it on, there's various things that happen that makes it impossible for them to finish the tests. So, you know, the energy levels, I think, are higher than what was anticipated. So, for instance, in the first instance, some of the anchors that held some of the magnetic coils ripped out, and some of the parts went flying through the accelerator and damaged the detectors. Sure. And so on. And so there's been problems all over this experiment.
Bird drop bread in there and everything else.
Yes, that's right. So there's been difficulties, but I think we're getting there slowly but surely. I believe that what they're going to find is going to be quite unusual, that they're going to be quite surprised at what they find there, and that we're going to learn a whole lot about a whole new level of physics from these experiments.
As long as they don't create a black hole on us, Nassim. Yeah?
Well, you see, my theory, George, says that every atom is already a mini black hole.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not too worried about it. You know, the geometry of the experiment, the dynamics they're using, if they create anything close to what I believe is a singularity, which is basically an atom, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
You know, I think that it's going to be short-lived and dissipate quite fast because the geometry is not quite right.
Well, Nassim, what do you think is really happening with HARP? I mean, what are they doing over there with these things?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. HARP has been a project that has been ongoing for a fairly long time now. There's obviously facilities in many different countries around the world, and there is, you know, the... What are they using HARP to do is difficult to answer. You know, most people are not privy to this level of information. And, but, you know, people ask me, well, if you believe they're poking holes in the ionosphere, why would they be doing that? You know, is it just because they want to demonstrate their power or so on? I believe, and, you know, at the end of the day, and this is really, again, you know, an opinion and a conclusion I've come to just because, you know, from the studies I've made, maybe our governments are trying to reduce global heating by, you know, removing some of the blanketing that our ionosphere produced.
Because this thing must be on 24/7, you know? They must have the switch on all the time.
Mm. Well, you know, it's hard to say, but certainly, you know, that could be a reason why they're poking holes and trying to allow some of the heat to escape. So there might be humanitarian reasons.
Absolutely. We've had Nick Begich on the program, who was one of the first to publicize HARP, which stands for the High Frequency Active Oral Research Program. And what they say on their own website is that it's a scientific endeavor aimed at studying the properties and behavior of the ionosphere with an emphasis on understanding and enhancing communications and surveillance systems for civilian and defense purposes. Now, what the heck does that mean?
Well, you know, there's many reasons why you would want to bulge the ionosphere and be able to control one of those bulges. You know, for instance, it would provide you a means to communicate across the horizon, meaning that instead of bouncing a signal across to a satellite, which is a weak link in the defense system, you know, and then bouncing it back further across the horizon on the Earth, if you could bulge the ionosphere in such a way that you can use it as a reflective lens to send a signal across the ionosphere, across the atmosphere, and across the horizon, then, you know, it would be an advantageous device for communication in military industrial complex. So, you know, that is probably what they're thinking of when they're describing this on their website, communication and surveillance done without the satellite structure, but actually directly from the ionospheric bulge. Then there's many other things you might be able to do. Like I said, you know, you might be able to create, you know, anomalies in which you're able to release some of the greenhouse effects that are occurring on our planet, or you may be able to modify weather or do things that, you know, military complex industry, look for in their development.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. But whatever it is, I just have a feeling that it's a little more sinister than they present it to be.
Yes. In general, the whole concept of defense, which in general should be called offense in our planet, is sinister in general. I wish humans would get along a little better.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you've got to get up to the enterprisemission.com website. I'm curious, when you have some time, and Nassim, to just to read Richard Hoagland's analysis mm-hmm. of the Norway spiral. He talks a little bit about HAARP in that, too.
Yes, and, it's very interesting. I'd love to study it more and see what he concluded to.
Tell me a little bit more about your theories of fractals in geometry and what that means to all of us.
Well, early on in my evolution, I started to realize that maybe we couldn't just account for our reality, like all the atoms that makes up our body and everything else around us, just with the concept of little billiard balls we call atoms that are flying around, that there may be a deeper fractal reality that's occurring. And what I mean by that, there's not really an God particle. There's not really a smallest particle that makes up all our reality, that the smaller particle could be divided again and divided again and divided again, and that if we kept on building larger and larger accelerators, we'd get smaller and smaller and smaller particles, and that there was no end to it. And when I start to think that way, I realize, well, maybe our reality is made of little singularity, little black holes, because black holes have this infinite nature, this infinite mass, this infinite density at its center. And when I start to explore that and look at the atom with that lens, it started to become evident that this must be the case. I started writing scaling laws, showing that, from universal size, I mean, most people don't know, but our universe obeys the condition of a black hole. If you take the mass of the universe and you put it in the radius that we believe our universe is, and you calculate if that mass-radius relationship obeys the condition of a black hole, it does, meaning light should not be able to escape. The idea that we live inside a black hole and that everything inside it are smaller black holes in different scales that we're on the outside of, so we're seeing the radiative dynamic of the outside event horizon of a black hole start to come into my field, and I start to think that way, and I start to write physics that way and mathematics that way, and it all added up to correct predictions in many different ways, eventually bringing me to write this paper, the Schwarzschild proton, which just won an award in Europe, and that described the atom as this mini black hole with infinite density, the nuclei of an atom as a mini black hole. And that really has many implications in physics, but as well in philosophy.
I would love to get your take on why you think we're here and what we are.
Well, that's a large question. But if I were to attempt to answer that, I would say that, I think that, part of the Schwarzschild proton paper is I show that actually the space between things, the vacuum, is not empty, and that inside the proton, there's all the energy available for all protons in the universe. And so that everything is entangled with this web of information across space. The vacuum is actually what connects all things.
It's wireless. You just don't really see it, do you?
That's right. And you don't experience it because, just like a good example, just like a wireless router, gives you internet, but you don't necessarily experience it directly. This vacuum energy is present everywhere, And it's a little bit of a reversal from the common thinking that the material world defines the space. Then I start to think maybe the space defines the material world. And when I start to think that way, I start to see that relationship between all things, and the math started to support it. Leads you to realize that maybe this great adventure we're on is actually a feed from the whole universe, that like, and the multiverse and the megaverse, that we're on the very end of this fractal structure of space. Looking back at ourselves, looking back at the universe, and learning about ourselves, that like it's a whole network of information that we're part of, and that we're not actually isolated, but we're part of this amazing will works of nature, and we're like little probes learning and exploring the universe from our own very specific perspective.
Could you say at this point, based on what you've been putting together all these years as a physicist, first and foremost, that there's got to be some design behind all of this, that it just didn't happen by a roll of the dice?
I think absolutely. I don't believe in the roll of the dice, and certainly Einstein made very famous statements about this as well. I think that like it's a self-organizing system that, you know, it shows that the universe is actually learning about itself, and as it learns about itself, the information that it gathers coalesce and synergize to produce the next set of questions, which are now answered again, and then so on and so on, like in a feedback of information network. So the system self-organizes. You're really asking a question about God. And in this view, God is everything. Everything, you know, interacting with everything is learning about itself and self-organizing, making very, very complex system in very short amount of times, which is a big problem in science. We can't really explain how, you know, the complexity of our biosphere occurred, and so well organized. I mean, it's an amazing thing. Even one human being is quite remarkable. If you take all the DNA in one human being and you wrap it around the world, you can wrap it 5 million times. That's all the information compactified inside yourself to make you actually work and a very coordinated way for a long period of time. And so this level of organization, I believe, is the result of self-organizing feedback structure that's present in the space-time structure right around you right now in the vacuum.
And it's probably, if there are multiverses, and you think there are two, that it could be the same throughout?
Yes, it could be the same throughout in like various scales, and actually my scaling laws, the papers I published showing scaling laws seem to show that there's very specific, very complementary and similar dynamics that are occurring from universal size all the way down to subatomic particles, and that there's a fundamental physics that unifies all this, and that's been my great adventure.
Still to come, more with Nassim Hedamain on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. And our special guest tonight, Nassim Hedamain, his website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Now, it is called the Renaissance Resonance Project.org, the Resonance Project.org, which is linked right now to coasttocoastam.com. Nassim, if you had a group of kids in school and adults, they were all thrown into the same mix, how would you explain the Big Bang to them?
Well, you know, it's been interesting to teach kids because, I love to do it. I teach my theories to kids all the time. And I really enjoy it because they have such an open mind and a great imagination. Yeah. And they can visualize so well. But, I think in general, I would tell them that the Big Bang is most likely one of the bang that produce creation, that creation is constantly banging, that it's constantly being created in a continuous flow. I'd probably explain the standard model before that, which is not the same. The standard model assumed only one bang. But certainly, you know, I try to convey to them that creation is occurring constantly, that there's a constant reorganization of the system that we live in, that it's constantly undoing itself and redoing itself and undoing itself and redoing itself. And actually I was discussing this with my 4-year-old the other day, and after a few minutes of contemplation, he turned around and said, "You know, Papa, I think I can see it flickering in and out."
He might be right.
He might, I think that, like, it's like I was saying, it's this constant update of information that occurs in the universe that feeds back onto itself and reorganizes the system to continuously create higher and higher levels of complexity and higher levels of organization. And we see it in nature everywhere, and we're actually evidence of it ourselves.
What if there was a massive-sized object, Nassim, in the universe, and that is what blew up, and that is what all the planets might be, and all the stars,
mm-hmm.
remnants of this huge object, maybe this only object that was in our universe, that simply blew up?
Right. Well, you know, that's very close to the standard view of the Big Bang, either than the standard view starts with a very, very small object, an object the size of a singularity, which is 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, very, very small, billions of times smaller than an atom.
The human brain can't even comprehend that, can it?
Yes, and, you know, and there's evidence for it. And actually, you know, what I'm saying in my theory is that every atom is one of those. It's one of those little teeny singularities. But if you started with a large object, you'd have to ask yourself, where did the matter come from to produce that object in the first place?
True.
And, you know, so what I'm saying is that...
But even a small particle, I'd ask the same question.
Exactly. Where did it come from? How come it blew up? Where did the energy come from to produce all the matter mm-hmm. that came out of it? And all these questions are typically avoided by our current standard theories. We have very little understanding of what mass is. We have very little understanding of what magnetic fields are, electric fields, and so on. Most people think that most of these questions have been answered by advanced physics, but actually they remain great mysteries.
They're huge mysteries.
Yes.
And I'm not sure, not to put down folks who are physicists by any means, but I'm not sure... If you had 10 physicists in a room, you'd come up with the same theory. You might come up with 10 different theories.
Absolutely. Actually, that's one of the major issues in physics, that there's not necessarily a consensus on the views of the appropriate physics. Certainly, there's a standard view, and that's the view that's taught in universities by college professors and so on. But, you know... there is as well, you see, the new physics that are being written is the physics that are being written by physicists that are not necessarily completely sold to the standard view. And they are, you know, they're the kind that are thinking about new ideas, new ways of looking at things, and come up with various ways of describing something. And it's a little bit like, you know, the story of the elephant with the blind man, you know, like four blind men looking at an elephant, and one's got the tail, and one's got the leg, and one's got the trunk, and they start to disagree on what the elephant looks like because they're experiencing different parts of it. And I think the crux here is to actually find a unified theory, a theory that unifies all these different views. And that's a very difficult thing to do. I mean, Einstein spent most of his life working on it. And this I think that if this occur, and I believe we're very close to it, I believe actually that the work I've done with the Schwarzschild proton with the black hole atom is a very powerful step in that direction, that there's a possibility that when we understand these fundamental dynamics of physics, the change in our society will be tremendous. From, philosophical change and social change, but as well, very advanced technological changes.
Absolutely. Now, you've talked about what is called the power of spin. Explain that. What does that mean?
Well, that's another thing that, in general, in physics, is not well explained, is the spin component of our universe. For instance, if you ask, what's spinning the Earth? Well, you'll be told that it's conserved energy from the spin of our solar system, because the sun is spinning. And then if you ask, well, what's spinning the sun? And you'd be told it's conserved from the galactic spin. And then if you ask, well, what's spinning the galaxy? Then you'd be told, well, the cluster and the supercluster. And eventually you'd get back to the Big Bang. And that doesn't really tell you where spin came from.
And does every object out there spin?
It seems to be,
yeah. Isn't that weird all by itself? Every star, every planet, everything spins.
That's right. And even the atoms that you're made of, and that's a lot of atoms, billions and billions of atoms, and they're all spinning very close to the speed of light. And that's really remarkable, because they're spinning continuously for billions and billions and billions of years. And so for me, it was not adequate to say, well, it all started spinning in the Big Bang, and we're not going to tell you where the energy came from to do that. And it's been spinning ever since in a frictionless environment, because our environment is just not frictionless. There's all sorts of frictions in our universe, field interactions, plasma, and all this stuff. And so for me, I thought, no, there must be a source to the spin of everything. And I start to look at Einstein's equations of space-time, and I start to realize that torque and Coriolis effect had been removed from those equations. And I, with the help of Dr. Rauscher and Dr. Heisen, we've put spin or torque and Coriolis effect back into space-time to explain the origin of spin, the source of the spin of everything. Really, it really becomes the source of life, because everything spins into existence. And so it's like, think of it of like almost like space-time as a fluid spinning. And when it makes little eddy currents, when it makes little vortices, we see it as an atom or a particle.
What would happen if nothing spun?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, that's the thing. It may be a frame of reference thing. If nothing spun, it might be because you're spinning with it. I believe actually that there is zero spin at singularity, that when you reach that infinite nature at the center of the atom, that's like the center of the eye of the hurricane, where there's no wind.
Right, and it's calm.
Yeah, exactly. That's what centers our universe. That's what centers our galaxies. That centers our atoms and so on. The stillness.
So is there a stillness in our universe somewhere?
Yeah, at the center of all things.
You believe that, right in the middle?
Yes, absolutely.
Interesting.
Yeah. Just like a hurricane, or a tornado. And, it's a dynamic between spin and stillness that produces the feedback structure that makes information continuously flow through our universe, and the system self-organized that way, highly self-organized.
Okay, atoms are inanimate. They aren't alive, correct?
Right. Well, I mean, how you describe life.
They don't eat. They don't die. They're not rest. So here's my question.
Yes.
When an egg is fertilized and it turns into a baby, and the baby is born, okay?
Yeah.
Are there more atoms in that body than when it first started? That's my first question.
Yes, absolutely, because there is duplication of cells and there is nutrients that are being agglomerated to produce the duplication of cells. So, you know, we all started with one cell, and interestingly, we go through a very similar evolution that, you know, the monocellular system went through on Earth through its evolution to become, you know, very complex. A multicellular system, we all went through that same evolution when we were, you know, conceived from one cell that doubled up and so on, and eventually to produce the 100 trillion cells of our body, which are made out of billions of atoms.
Okay, so but here's my question. If these atoms, then, that aren't alive, and I'm thinking of alive in our terms,
yes,
and we have, you know, zillions of them in a child that become a human being, a grown full-size human being, when that person passes on and becomes rubble and dust and decays, What happens to the rest of those atoms that were there in that human? You know, zillions of them, now the body's gone. Where are they?
Well, you know, that's an interesting concept, an interesting thing to think about, because when you think about it, you could say that you're shedding millions of cells every minute.
Right.
And each cell is made of a lot of atoms. So you're basically constantly shedding a trail of atoms throughout your life.
But they don't die, right?
The atoms don't die.
No, so where do they go?
They continuously spin. They retain a state of relationship to other atoms in which they change phase. For instance, they, you know, may go back to the soil and become soil, or be digested by a worm, and, you know, they continuously, this is why I believe we live in this infinite feedback structure of creation, is that you can't actually find anything to disappear. You just see changes in the states of things. So all the atoms that you've always been made of, you know, all the way through your life, and all the atoms you will be made of when you die will still continue to do what they do, which is change state and recycle themselves, and they might end up in another human being not so far down the road.
Or in a soul.
Yeah. Well, you know, then the soul is another subject. You got to look at the atomic structure. As a self-organizing system, what would be the soul? Well, maybe the soul is the information that's gathered by such a system, the information that makes up you, you know, and that information is conserved as well. It most likely continues on, and there's no reason to think that it would not reorganize in another set of atoms at one point.
Do you think Einstein went through this same little perplexing thought mode?
I'm sure he did. When you read Einstein and when you study his life, I think Einstein was a great philosopher, a great thinker, and he was certainly not limited to the conventional views of physics, and that's what made him Einstein.
You know, getting back to your theory again of spin, as it's tied, let's say, to the creation of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Again, to me, and I keep harping back at this, even though we're not talking about harp anymore, it just sounds like it was planned. It was designed. You know, I'm not trying to have you say you believe in God. I'm not asking you that at all.
Uh-huh.
But it just sounds like there's way too much intelligence behind this. Somebody or something knew what it was doing.
Yes. Well, that's what I believe, is that the universe knows what it's doing. This is why it's highly organized. You know, it's like there is this underlying self-organizing energy that connects all things. And that's why it knows where everything is, because every little protons of every little atom is connected to all other protons in all of the universe. And some of the math I just written in that Schwarzschild paper is, you know, proves that. And so this idea that everything is connected and that it's all in communication, you know, makes it possible for systems to self-organize. So when you're talking about the intelligence of the universe, you're really talking about the intelligence of you. You know, you're an extremely intelligent person, and I don't mean you just personally, but...
What? Do you mean I'm not?
No. But human beings, you know, or any biological entity or, you know, or even maybe non-biological entity, there's an intelligence there. You're absolutely correct. And what I'm saying is that the intelligence is not an extra, you know, universal intelligence, like an overseeing intelligence. It's part of the system that makes up the universe itself. It's not separated from us. It's actually everything together is the intelligence.
Was it always there? Do you think it was even there before the Big Bang?
The Bang? Well, absolutely. I believe, you know, it was one of the hardest part in my study. It was to come to conclude that there was never a beginning and there'll never be an end. There was never a chicken or an egg. It's always both, that there's continuous, infinite cycles. And in one way, it feels like when you're trying to visualize that, it feels like unsettling. And, you know,
oh, it rattles your brain.
It does. But actually, when you concede to it, when you let go of an idea of a beginning and an end, which is really based on the frame of reference of a human being, you know, then all of a sudden there's a relaxation that you, oh, wow, there's this amazing continuous creation process that goes from infinitely back to infinitely forward, and I'm just part of this amazing will work of nature. It actually brings you to new levels of discoveries, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. What's new with your website?
Well, you know, I'm in the middle of revamping the website, so I'm, you know, getting ready to change it, and we're starting all sorts of new programs as well. The programs that I had started, the Emissary program, is still going, but we're starting a shorter program, which is the Delegate program, where people can come and spend 3 days or 2.5 days with me over a weekend, and we can go into the details of the theory, because so many times in my talks, it's just too short for me to explain all of the details of the theory. So a lot of people have been requesting that. So it's very exciting. We already had one Delegate program. It was very popular, and it was a great weekend. And there's another one coming in May for the East Coast in New York, and probably one coming up for Europe as well.
All right, very good. Well, when we come back, we have to put consciousness into the equation. And how does that fit? We'll be back in a moment with physicist Nassim Haddamain on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Nassim, what is the role of consciousness in all of this?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, I mean, many physicists are looking at trying to find a relationship between consciousness and the material world. In my views, they're not so separate. I think that they actually are related very deeply, that what we call consciousness is actually, a feedback. It's actually a sense of self, self-awareness, demands like a certain amount of information feedback in the system. So I think that it's inherent to the material world, that because of the way the material world actually works, consciousness is a part of it. It's permeating everything. It's part of everything. It's part of the structure of space itself. It's part of the way the material world comes to exist. And those are very, very deep philosophical questions.
Sure.
And I think that we're starting to get a glimmer on what that means, you know, to physics, and how the universe can self-organize in such amazing way as we see on our planet. And so I think there's a great horizon there for us.
Do you think that through consciousness that people can tap into each other, whether it's through telepathy or intuition?
Yes, all these phenomenons that have been reported by so many different people at different times, and not necessarily, you know, very unusual people like psychics and others, but you know, day-to-day, you know, normal people you see everywhere, having deja vu experiences and many different experiences that seem to, I mean, they're taught as psi experiences, they seem to show that there is a direct link between systems. And this is what I was talking about, is that every point is connected to every other point in our universe. So it makes sense that if we understand that, that information is available from any point to any other point. So in some sense, in certain circumstances, people could have experiences where they can telepathically connect with another person or some strange event where, you know, you think of a person and they call you, you know, there's all sorts of events that occur in everyday life that have to do with this interconnectivity that's already present from the atomic level up. And that actually those woo-woo effects are not so woo-woo. They're actually part of the physics of creation.
For people who have this ability to tap into this, yeah, and it takes training, but what do you think allows them to do it? Well, how does it work?
I think that it's actually available to most people. It's a question, as you said, of training and taking the time to actually experience the space around you, to experience the structure of creation around you, to tap into the field. I mean, so many of these people talk about tapping into the field, and I think when they talk about that, they're talking about this fundamental energy source that's at the source of the creation of everything that is in the space, and it holds all the information that coordinates all the atoms in the universe. And if you take the time, and I believe that this is why so many masters that have walked the earth talked about meditation and prayer and many different modalities, yoga and so on, to take the time to connect with this fundamental force at the source of creation. When you do that, then you start to what I call being a vacuum engineer. You start to connect with this force. You start to understand how it works, how it flows. Some of the Eastern tradition may call it Chi Master, others call it, you know, the Tao and so on. And that when you start to connect with that fundamental energy, you can manipulate it. You can manipulate it to produce benefit in health of other people. You can manipulate it to communicate with other people and so on in a non-linear way, in a way that is not commonly done.
Absolutely. Okay, to the phones we go now. Let's go to Jill in Chicago, Illinois. Hi, Jill. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm enjoying your show so much as I do every night.
Thank
I would
you.
Enjoy it more if we're here in Chicago. We could get the last 2 hours like we used to. But anyhow, I wanted to ask your guest what he feels or what he thinks and feels about the discrimination that I hear going on between the mainstream science community and the theory of intelligent design.
Well, that's a good question. Well, you know, there's been, you know, discrimination between the mainstream scientific community and many theories throughout the years. But, you know, there is, it's all I can say about that is that in general, it's very difficult for people to accept ideas that, you know, that there's some creative force that's not, you know, completely materialistic in nature. And I think that the difficulty there is that actually the middle ground between the completely materialistic view and the more religious view, that actually, you know, it's a blend of the two, really. That's in one way what I'm talking about, although I believe that that energy that's self-organized can be reasoned, can be, you know, described in appropriate mathematics and appropriate physics, which does not make it non-divine in any case. It just shows that there's fundamental mechanics that this energy uses to produce creation that can be described in appropriate physics and mathematics. And so I think that there's a middle ground between those two opposite views, and I wish more people would look for that middle ground. And I think the key is that feedback between the material world and the vacuum structure. I believe that the intelligent design people are thinking about this all prevailing godlike power, and that the material people, the standard model, is thinking of the material world, and I think it's both.
Tell me a little bit more about your work with this geometric array that you believe is fundamental to creation.
Well, when you study the structure of the vacuum, when you study how the space would self-organize all of our material world, you come to conclude that there must be some fundamental geometric parameter that it's following to self-organize, like some kind of geometry of that fractal nature must occur, like a fundamental, you know, pattern that nature follows. And then when you look at nature all around you, you find that pattern everywhere, meaning like you look at a flower, you look at a tree, you look at a human being, or you know, all of the natural world, and you see patterns everywhere, and they repeat themselves in very constant mathematical function, meaning like, for instance, you find the phi ratio 1.618 everywhere, the Fibonacci series everywhere, and so on. So then you must come to conclude that this self-organizing energy has this fundamental geometric pattern. And when you combine that with knowledge that was left by ancient civilization all around the world that seemed to point to very specific geometric structure, and advanced physics that seemed to show that this, you know, some fundamental geometry at the source of creation, then, you know, it starts to come together. And as I did that, I came to very specific geometries, very specific conclusions about these geometries, and the possibility of understanding this fractal structure and applying it to technology to transform our world.
Let's go to San Diego. Greg, you're up, and you're a first-time caller. Hi, Greg.
Yeah, Nassim is he's blowing my mind. I've studied his work. I think he's the next Einstein.
Great.
Thank you.
I want to know about, I know how you compare everything to atoms, and an atom has a structure of a nucleus and then space and then the electrons around it. And then I started to get into the hollow earth theory, and it seems to make sense. What do you think about that?
Oh, good.
And if you do believe in it, does it apply to all the planets, all the celestial bodies in the universe?
Yes, very good question. You know how I was describing the center of hurricanes as the point of stillness, you know? And the center of the hurricane is not only the point of stillness, but it's the point where, you know, there is not so much material. The density is much lower. And so my the analogy stands for what you were describing. If this is all correct, if singularity is at the center of everything, if everything is connected in that way, then the vacuum, yes, space is present at the center of all things, and it's present in different scales at different level, meaning that, you know, the singularity at the center of our Earth would have pulled much of the matter around itself, into itself, and, you know, leave a space there. So it is very possible that the center of the Earth has a hollow core, and there is new geological evidence that that's correct. There's many new studies that are showing that there may be an empty space in the middle of our Earth, you know, and it would apply to all the planets and the sun and the galaxies and so on.
Okay, we've got Gary now in San Diego on Coast to Coast. Hey, Gary, thanks for calling.
Hey, I'm glad to talk to you guys. I want to ask about matter, but first I'd like to say that our DNA has been proposed as a length that can be wrapped around the world. Yet if that has ever been proven and attempted, most of us will never know or be able to prove such an event. All of us who are alive right now and expect to see an enlightened world can only achieve such an understanding through telepathy and not through spoken word. Depending on the primitive act of speaking through our mouth and not through our mind is what makes our progress slow. That being said, I would like to know that some people say that matter cannot be created or destroyed. What do you believe in that, in the fact that we aren't born at 150 pounds or so, we're born only at a few pounds? As we grow, matter seems to be created. Doesn't that mean that matter expands?
Well, so in your example, actually that was an earlier question as well. From George, I think that, certainly in a human being, we certainly don't start at 150 pounds because that would be a problem for our mothers. The material world that's accumulating to make a human being is actually being extracted from nutrients in the environment. It's not, the atoms are not literally just appearing out of nowhere. Meaning like your mother is eating food and there's all sorts of nutrients that are coming in. There's all sorts of atoms. There's all sorts of transformation that are occurring in the molecular structure that is agglomerating. And what's remarkable is that it's agglomerating in a very precise, very organized way, which is a thing, it's a problem that's not really addressed in our biology or in our physics, and it keeps doing the same thing very precisely, very accurately for most people in the world, but that's not really matter creation. If you're asking me about matter creation, I would say yes, I believe that matter is constantly being created. It's constantly, the bang is constantly happening at the center of galaxies, at the center of suns, and maybe even at the center of planets, and that might be why planets continuously grow, as I believe. I believe that, the physics of this continuous creation process is going to free us from the idea that there was just a big bang, and it's just in a random way we, by an incredible amount of luck what is called in physics mathematical fluctuation, we happen to come together and be so well suited for the experience. And so what I'm saying is that, yes, I believe there is matter creation continuously going on. Our universe is a continuous creation system.
Tell me about the award that you got in Europe for your work on the Schwarzschild proton.
Well, this is a paper that was, that was presented to a scientific community conference in Belgium at the University of Belgium, and it's in the proceedings of this conference and is currently under peer review and getting ready to be published. And when I went to the conference, there's a certain amount of awards that are given for each fields of physics or other fields of science that are present there at the conference. And my paper won the Best Paper Award for relativistic and quantum theory and field theory and so on. And so it was a great honor for me. I was quite surprised because the paper is quite radical. The paper describes atoms as mini black holes. It describes them in terms of semi-classical physics that would be, Einstein's equations and mechanical equations instead of using quantum theory. and it gets the right answers for the energy of the nuclei and its dynamics and so on, its measured values in laboratories. So it gives the right answer. It unifies the fields because it uses Einstein's field equation instead of quantum theory, and it's quite disturbing to the standard model. So I was very surprised to receive an award. I was very glad, though.
How many people are working on that, on the same kind of theories? Are you out there all by yourself?
Well, you know, I've been out there by myself for a long time.
Yes, you have.
Yes, but
sometimes with a noose around you, right?
That's right. It's it can get pretty hairy out there. But I think that more and more people are warming up to the idea. I mean, think about it, George. When you think of an atom continuously spinning with an electron going at near the speed of light, I mean, you know, it starts to look more and more like a mini black hole, a very energetic, you know, singularity. And I think that that actually is the correct answer. Now, whether or not we can write the physics to describe it appropriately, I think is the crux. And it's taken us a very long time to understand that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question about that. Well, stay with us. When we come back at the top of the hour, full hour of phone calls left for Nassim Haramain. And then in the last hour of the program, Joshua P. Warren joins us with his paranormal moment as well. And I invite you all to go to Nassim's website, which is the RenaissanceProject.org, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. I'm George Norrie. Don't touch your dial. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, here we are. We'll take your phone calls. Nassim Haramain, our special guest tonight. He's also got a DVD called Crossing the Event Horizon, Rise to the Equation. Tell me about that, Nassim.
Well, it's a 4-DVD set that goes through all the information relevant to, you know, a layman description of the theory and all the research I've done in ancient civilization and in various fields of expertise. And it describes the link between all these things, the link between advanced physics and ancient knowledge and even, you know, the possibility that we're being talked to by crop circle and taught about geometry and so on, and many different other things are involved. It's almost 8 hours long. There's with the special features, the discussion there about the sun and ancient texts from the Vedic tradition and so on.
All right, let's go to the calls. We'll pick it up by first of all going to Santa Barbara, California, west of the Rockies. Hey, David, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call, George.
Sure, Dave.
You know, I've gone to your website and read it years ago, or a year ago at least, I think now, and really looked at a lot of your videos on the net, so I'm pretty familiar with what you've done. I've been studying physics for a few years now, daily, for several hours a day, and so I have a pretty good grasp on alternative sciences, which I think is really where it's working, And you're really at the kind of the top of the field there. Now, I'm serious. I really do believe that. There's a question that I have for you that I haven't been able to get an answer for with many of the scientists that I know that are also in the alternative science. And then I got something I want to let you know about, too. And anyway, I was wondering if you believe that three space is, that's the three dimensions or the quantum vacuum or whatever you want to call it, that ether that's out there. There's a million different words for the same thing. And that's one of the problems. We don't have the same language as the rest of the physicists.
Right.
Now, this stuff is actually collapsing into, it's collapsing in through the atom or the protons and neutrons, whatever else is in the atom, into another dimension. Is that what you think is taking place?
Actually, you know, two things. One is I appreciate the comments and your background. It's great to hear that. And you know, this is why I call the vacuum the vacuum. You know, you could call it the plenum, you could call it the chi, you could call it, you know, like you're right, there's so many different names for the same thing. But I'm confined to using the word vacuum because when I say the vacuum to a physicist, specifically to a quantum physicist, then in general, they know what I'm talking about. And I'm talking about this density of the vacuum that's called a Planck's density, which is 10 to the 94 or 10 to the 93 grams per centimeter cubed. It's extremely dense. It's more dense than all the stars in the universe put together in a centimeter cube of space. If you did that, if you took all the stars in the universe and you stuck them in a centimeter cube of space, you'd have about 10 to the 55th grams per centimeter cube. So you'd still be 38 to 39 orders of magnitude less than the density of the vacuum that actually is present at the atomic level. And that's been measured in laboratory using the Casimir effect and other things. And so basically, yes, I believe that it is collapsing, that actually the vacuum density, the energy of the vacuum is what produces the phenomenon that we call the atom. And it's because it's moving towards singularity, and through these movements towards singularity, you, as I said earlier, you can think of it as a fluid, you know, as a little vortex that's being generated as it's being sucked towards singularity. And that dynamic produces the magnetic and electromagnetic fields, the electron cloud, and all the dynamics we see in the atom, and which is 99.99999% space. And when we think about it this way, we start to realize there's a relationship between the center of the system and the edge of the system. So I don't believe it's going in another dimension as it collapses. I believe that actually it's feeding back, because as it spins towards singularity, it increases in velocity. So then centrifugal forces eventually and Coriolis forces take over and pulls it out at the equator of the system, and that's how I ended up with a double torus structure that you can see on my website. And in that double torus structure, information is moving in towards the center and then radiating out from the equator and moving back into the center, and in a continuous feedback loop that is the source of this, information network, which continuously learns about itself.
There you go. David, follow up on that?
Yeah, I do. That's pretty much exactly my view, too, except that I thought a portion of it might be collapsing into another dimension. Now, the one thing that you may not be aware of, because it's not published, is that there's a scientist out there that's a friend of mine, that is actually, through very carefully controlled electrical fields, been able to pop a proton from the quantum vacuum. And if you can pop one proton out of a quantum vacuum, then you can eventually pop a planet or a galaxy.
Very interesting. I am not aware of that experiment, and that I believe that this is actually possible in our future. Like I said, if everything emerges from space and returns to space, then it is possible that if we understand the dynamics, and I believe the dynamics have to do with spin and velocities, angular momentum, that when we understand those dynamics, we can produce material directly out of the structure of space.
Nassim, I'm always fascinated at how incredible people have gotten into the fields that they're in. How did this happen for you? Interested in science when you were a little boy? What happened?
I was interested in science when I was a little boy. But I was actually very curious about the natural world, about our existence here and how it all worked. And, I wasn't doing so great at school, so I didn't, continue to explore that in the standard system of schooling. I had to do much of my studying independently, some 20 years of physics independently. And, that allowed me to develop in a way in which I could think my own thoughts, come to my own conclusions, and develop new views that are not necessarily inside the box that is taught inside the institutions.
Very good. Next up, we go to Atlanta, Georgia, east of the Rockies. Jonathan, go ahead, John.
George, Haseem, great show, great show.
He's one of a kind, isn't he?
Yeah, I'd like to, George, I'd like to hear maybe David Sarita and your guest on tonight. Maybe they could team up on Michio Kaku.
Oh, what a night that would be, huh?
Haseem, you mentioned the Vedas. I think whoever it was that wrote the story of Indra's net had some great insight into, entanglement and the nature of entanglement, the connectedness of all matter and the universe. But David Sarita has also talked about, like what you were saying about singularity within all atoms and particles, I guess, popping in and out of the singularity. David Sarita was talking about, what's his name, Paul Dirac. They're one of the developers of quantum theory, and his theories kind of track along with what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Maybe. And also, how does that relate to, I'm sure you're familiar with the double slit experiment of firing an electron gun at a screen with two slits and it creating a wave pattern on a screen, and when it's measured and being observed, it collapses into more of a particle form on the screen. How does that relate to, you know, the nature of the atom and the popping in and out of singularity and the observer nature of reality, like John Wheeler talks about?
Oh, very good question. First on Dirac, some of the papers are available on my website. One of them in particular was a mathematical paper where I showed a direct correlation between, you know, the double torus structure and the Dirac equation that describes the electron cloud, the electron and positron cloud. But certainly, the double slit experiment is a very interesting experiment, and it really, the interpretation that was given to it is something that I've modified a little bit, and I have a little bit of a different interpretation of what occurs there. And the difference is that the standard view assumes that the particle that's fired from the gun is in free space, that there is nothing around it, that it's flow, that there's absolute vacuum, that there is nothing there. And so it becomes mysterious and actually is the source of the, interpretation of quantum theory and so on. It becomes very esoteric, very mysterious, because sometimes it's a particle and sometimes it's a wave, and if it's observed, it's changed and all this. But if you make a different assumption, if you make an assumption which is, appropriate, since there's lots of evidence that the vacuum is full, that the particle is moving through a fluid-like structure, through a vacuum-like energy of the vacuum structure, think of it as a boat on the ocean. As it moves, it makes bow waves. And so as the particle moves, if there's only one slot in the experiment, then it will make a pattern of particle on the other side of that slot. But then if there's two slots, then the waves that the particle makes through the structure of the vacuum as it's moving through space would go through the second slot. And now you'd have a particle and a wave at the same time. And you'd think, oh, my God, this thing is a particle and a wave at the same time. And then imagine that you put an instrument in the field that measures. You could call it an observer. And now that observer is in the same field, and it's making waves in the structure of the vacuum, it's making disturbance in the structure of the vacuum, so now you'd get a completely different result again. And so it becomes less mysterious when you take a different approach and start to realize that nothing is in free space.
You know, it's amazing. So many people are so fascinated with physics.
Yes, because I think it's instinctively a fundamental question of how did reality get there and how did we get here and so on. I think most people have that inside of them somewhere.
If you went back into time, Haseem, and you were with Isaac Newton, what would you ask him?
What would I?
You get one question for Isaac Newton.
Uh-huh. One question for Isaac Newton. I would ask him, how difficult was it to deal with all of the rest of the scientific community?
Next up, we go to Vinny in Vancouver. I like that. Hey, Vinny.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Good. Good.
This is a great show, by the way.
Thanks.
And if I could, I'd like to just use the two previous callers as a springboard.
All right, sure.
In fact, even the double slit experiment, really. One of the things that's always fascinated me in looking at this stuff, especially from an ulterior perspective, is how the concept of time kind of plays into it. And what I'd like to ask the doctor is, like, you know, with regards to this interpretation, which I think was even classified as the Copenhagen interpretation, mm-hmm. And with regards to just quantum mechanics in general, isn't there kind of a logical discontinuity as far as cause and effect? And doesn't that really kind of play into why the standard model isn't really, why most people just have a hard time with the standard model, because it really doesn't factor in cause and effect?
Yes, it's a discontinuity in understanding of the mechanics of creation. You know, all of a sudden, quantum theory, and you're correct, the Copenhagen interpretation, jumped to a model of the atomic structure of the way the material world is made that is very non-mechanical, very esoteric, that where particles can do all sorts of things that are, you know, not thought to be possible from mechanical function in the macro world. And, you know, in one way, and certainly Einstein thought so, this was a cop-out, a way to not have to, like, think harder and figure out what are these experiments truly showing us? You know, Einstein truly believed that there was a fundamental mechanical function to the atomic level, that there was geometry involved, and that there must be a way to understand this in a way that, you know, that makes more fundamental sense in terms of the mechanics of creation, instead of a very esoteric theory that says, oh, particles can be waves and particles at the same time, and you can't visualize it, and you shouldn't try to visualize it, and, you know, that, you know, entanglement particles can, you know, be millions and millions apart from each other, and you change one and the other one change instantaneously and all this. I mean, the fact that these experiments are there shows us that there must be some fundamental dynamics that we don't understand. But instead, what I believe happened is we jumped to conclusions that were convenient for our equations. And one of those conclusions was when we discovered that the protons are highly charged particles and they're squished together in the nuclei of an atom, very, very close together, and they have a high charge. You know, the mathematics in classical mechanics and static electricity should say that that the energy of these protons, like two magnets coming together, should repel, you know, each other, and the atom should not exist. Well, instead of trying to reassess our idea of what an atom is, we came up with the idea that there's some kind of strong, mysterious force that holds the atom together. We calculated how strong it had to be, and we just stuck it in there with no source for it, no explanation where the mechanics came from to produce that force or anything like that. And so, you know, what I'm showing now is, no, there is actually fundamental mechanics that produce that force, and it's called a mini black hole. And when you have a mini black hole singularity at the nuclei of an atom, you have exactly the amount of force necessary to hold the protons together. And it's understandable that they couldn't come to that conclusion then. Black holes were not even discovered at the time. You know, they were theoretically predicted by Einstein's equation, but even Einstein didn't like the idea that his equation predicted singularities and black holes.
Nassim, when we come back, we'll take final phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. We'll be right back. Nassim, tell me a little bit more about your training programs and your conferences and your speeches.
Oh, well, you know, at the Resonance Project, we are putting together, like, organizational structures so that we can help the public to, you know, get deeper into the science and philosophy and the ancient culture and knowledge that I've gathered all through these years. And so, you know, we kept on running into issues where people were saying, well, you know, I love your seminars and your talk and everything, but, you know, it's so fast and there's so much information and I need a little more time and all this. So we finally started to give organize for weekend seminars that I call delegate programs. And in the delegate program, you know, we spend 2 days and a half together, and I go through all the information, and you know, people are able to ask questions, and we spend a lot of time together, and it's a wonderful weekend all together, and lots of learning and exploration. And then there's the emissary program, and the emissary program is a program I set up because I need to duplicate myself. It's important for people to get this information, and it's really hard for me to continue to do research, ongoing research, and at the same time be out there giving talks everywhere in the world. So I start to train people so that they could give the talks, and that's more of a elaborate program. It's 10 days altogether, and people get my presentation and a big book, and we study together, and then when they come out, they're ready to give talks.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Long Beach, California. Hey, Ralph, go ahead. First-time caller.
Hello, George.
Hey.
Hey, Nassim, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Oh, thank you.
I had a quick, reasonable theory here. The thing was, is I always had a curiosity about the sun and all, and you know how we were taught that it has certain layers and whatnot?
Yes.
Okay, but technically we've never really dissected a star to actually know what's inside of it, and I know it's just some kind of a thing with nuclear fusion and whatnot, but my kind of reasonable thing here would be, since space is supposedly made out of carbon dioxide, when you have fire and you surround it by carbon dioxide, it technically would put it out, correct?
Yes. If the yes.
And so, I mean, I don't know, in theory, because of the fact that oxygen fuels a fire, wouldn't it be reasonable that oxygen, even as a gas, would probably be fueling the sun from the inside?
That's a good question, actually. You know, the thoughts, the current thoughts on the reason why the sun is burning is nuclear fusion. That is, the nuclei of the atoms are so densely packed at certain levels of density of the sun that it starts fusing under its own weight, and that's the energy output that we see. So, but there is all sorts of really strange things about the sun, the way, you know, that we would, most people think we know why the sun is burning and how it's burning and all this stuff. Actually, there's anomalies there. For instance, in order for nuclear fusion to occur that way, a certain amount of particles called neutrinos should be produced, and we know how much neutrinos should be produced. Well, when we try to detect those neutrinos, we are missing some 80% of the neutrinos that should be produced in order for the sun to burn. So that's a big anomaly. There's other anomalies, like the fact that the corona of the sun is much hotter than the surface of the sun. Interesting facts that most people don't know about. For instance, the fact that water seems to emerge from sunspots, which are large vortices, large black vortices on the surface of the sun. And there we see, you know, spectral lines of water come out. You wouldn't expect that. you know, right beside the fire of the sun. And so, yeah, oxygen and so on. And so there is very complex physics involved there, very complex dynamics that are going on. And I believe wholeheartedly, in the last section of my scaling law paper that you can find on our website, I describe the fact that the sun's core is in the correct ratio relative to the galactic core for the sun to host a mini black hole at its center. This theory says that these power levels, the dynamics that makes the sun burn, or the dynamics that makes planets like Jupiter and Saturn emanate more energy or radiate more energy than it receives from the sun, or the fact that the center of the Earth produces large amount of heat and electromagnetic fields and so on, is because they are powered by little singularities, by little black holes.
Okay, thank you. Let's go next to Brooklyn, New York. Jan, it's your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hi.
Hi.
You asked earlier about, you were talking about how the nutrients affect matter. Now, I was wondering, the GM food now that's being served to human beings, how do you think it's going to affect matter? Do you think people are going to be born with dumber brains? And also, the Union of Concerned Scientists and the American Academy of Environmental Medicine just came out last year and said how it's affecting people's liver and spleen and aging, and even GM food doesn't even give more yield. So
all right. What's your take, Nassim, on GM foods? You're changing things, aren't they?
They are. And, you know, they're changing things at levels where we have very little control, little understanding, and where the chain of events that makes our biology and our biosphere possible and operative and striving is a very, very delicate chain. And messing around with it, I think, is not a good idea. And, I think that it's been shown that things could be done in a completely different way to produce all the food we need and so on. So I think that it's really important that we go back to a level of reverence for nature and take a little pause on the expenditure of our technology and our capacity to modify things before we put them into the environment.
Okay, next up we've got you, Wally, in Flat Rock, Michigan, east of the Rockies. Hi, Wally.
Hey, thank you, George.
Sure.
Thank you for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I wanted to ask your guest a couple of questions. First, I heard him mention neutrinos a few minutes earlier. And I know a neutrino is so minute, it can pass through an atom without even touching it. Am I correct?
Yes, it's very.
And there are some. There are things even smaller, like quarks,
uh-huh,
that are smaller than neutrinos.
Uh-huh.
And the distance between these particles is relative to possibly the distance between the Earth and the nearest star.
Uh-huh.
Now, this space is so, I think space is probably the key to practically everything in physics.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. That's exactly where I'm coming from. I'm saying that the space is what's producing the phenomenon that we call matter. Basically, when we look at particles, we're looking at the little jiggling of the space, a little oscillation of the space. And because it produces an energetic effect, we say, oh, there's something over here. But then when we look carefully at that thing, we find that it's mostly made out of space. You're absolutely right. I mean, the atom is 99.99999% space. You don't expect that when you look at the material world. You think, oh, my God, it's very dense, you know, when you touch the table. But actually, it's mostly space. And you can find very dynamic energy structures inside that space. It's not dead space. It's not empty space. It's very energetic. And when you try to calculate how energetic it is, it's incredible. The density of the energy available in the space is remarkable. And I think it's really something we need to explore, because I don't believe that we're in a universe that's running down, that's low in energy, that put us on this planet that with no means to achieve higher levels of energy and so on, either than pumping oil out of the ground and so on. So I think that is the wave of the future.
Okay, very good. Couple more calls to go. Kennedy in Taos, New Mexico, first-time caller. Hi, Kennedy.
Hi, George. Hi, Nassim. I'm proud to say that I am a delegate of the Resonance Project. It is an amazing, amazing program. Nassim, I'd like to know briefly, and I'll take my answer off the air, what you think of the theory of fractal time in applying the phi ratio and the fractal nature of the universe to a theory of time.
Yes, very good. Fractal, you see, in the view that I'm bringing forward, time is a function of the frame dragging of space. And so let me explain that a little bit. You know, this vacuum energy, this vacuum structure, you could think of it as a little bit like if you were steering a pot of molasses and, you know, it would drag behind a little bit where you're steering. That's called frame dragging. And it actually is predicted by Einstein field equations. And it's been attempted to be measured. It was measured in various ways. And it's somewhat confirmed. And so what I'm saying is that I absolutely agree. I think that time is directly related to this fractal division of the space, this fractal scaling of the space. So, for instance, time for a galaxy size is completely different than time for a human being on the surface of a planet, or time for an atom is different, again, because each scales of the fractal defines a different frame of reference for the time structure.
Okay, we've got Jen in Cincinnati, Ohio. Now it's your turn. Hi, Jen.
Yes, hello. Nassim had mentioned earlier about sacred geometry.
Yes.
And I was wondering what he thought about the possibility of Merkaba being like a hyperdimensional aspect of spirit.
Oh, that's a good question. I think that many ancient texts talked about the fundamental geometry of space as sacred geometry, because they thought this is a fundamental geometry of creation, so they thought of it as sacred. And, you know, and because these ancient civilizations were not necessarily very technical, they were not very advanced, and maybe because they got the information from very advanced beings that they were in contact with, they may not have completely understood it. And so most of the information is always interpreted in very esoteric, philosophical interpretation. I think it has to do much more with the physics of creation itself. And, you know, and since, and if it's correct, if these geometries, when they're decoded, give the formula, the mathematics for the foundation of our existence, then for sure it should apply to the structure of our consciousness, the structure of the information that makes us who we are, and if you wanted to call it the soul, you know. And so it'd be the geometry of our soul in the structure of the vacuum, absolutely.
Okay, next up we have a San Diego caller west of the Rockies. It's Tom. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
Oh, hi, George. Nassim and George both, you're invited to our Sun God Festival down here. It's a mix of music and science students.
When is that?
San Diego. It's end of March.
Okay.
My question is this. We often hear and learn on Coast to Coast about the string theory, about membranes, about dark matter and dark energy, and those are the terms that most of us have learned about this subject. Could you compare and contrast your theories to those standard theories? Last Friday, Michio Kaku said that this is the only thing left for physicists to hang on to. It's the number of dimensions and the types of strings. There's nothing else to be discussed any longer.
Yes. Well, you know, this is a typical thing that occurs in physics. And by the way, thank you for the invitation. I'd love to go to the Sun God Festival if I get a chance. But I think that in physics and in science in general, we go from, interpretation to very complex description of what we're trying to achieve, in our understanding. And then eventually somebody comes along or, a group of individuals or so on. And, and then a simple view emerges. And I just have that sense when you look at the complexity of string theory and many difficulties that are involving dark matter and dark energy. I mean, dark matter and dark energy is a little bit like the strong force, you know. It's like, oh, we're just going to invent a kind of matter that doesn't radiate, that just in the right percentage and exactly the right place to make the equation work, you know. But we're not going to say where it came from, how it got there, you know, and so on. And so, you know, I don't necessarily agree with that approach to physics. I believe that if we run into a problem, for instance, missing some 96% of the mass of the universe, most likely is because we made an error in our interpretation somewhere, an error in our equation somewhere. And if we revise our previous approach, I think we can repair that. And part of it is to realize that atoms are mini black holes.
Okay, let's go to one more final caller, Jess in Lancaster, California. Go ahead, Jess, real quickly.
Hey, how you doing? It's actually Jeff. Anyways, I don't know if it's a question or a thought, is space goes on forever, right? Well, and let's say an atom is the smallest thing there is, and you cut an atom in half, and you can always keep going and going and going smaller, smaller, smaller. So I've always wanted to say that as much as space can go on forever, so can small. You can never not have something. So I don't know,
Very good.
Go ahead, Basim.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying is actually when you start cutting the atom in pieces, eventually you start realizing that what you're cutting in piece that you think is some kind of material world is actually the space that you're dividing. And, that kind of twists your view of the universe around. All of a sudden, the space is what produces the atomic structure, not the atomic structure defining the space.
I would have liked for you to have been our physics teacher when we were kids, Nassim, except you're younger than we were.
Well, hopefully, eventually, this will be the physics that I taught.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Nassim Hedamain.